Hello and welcome to the Slightly Foxed podcast from Hoxton Square in East London. Episode 6 now, and we are celebrating because the Sunday Times has just recommended Slightly Foxed as podcast of the week. Needless to say, we're all delighted. And if you're new to the podcast, welcome. You've picked the perfect moment to join us. As regular listeners know, this is a podcast about lost and lesser-known books and the art of publishing, and it comes to you from the kitchen table of this little independent publishing house. Last time, we talked about republishing with Donna Coonan from Virago Modern Classics. This time, we're looking at biography, but I suspect the conversation will range far and wide, as usual. My name is Philippa Lamb, and the Slightly Foxed founders are here. Gail Perkis.
Hello.
And Hazel Wood.
Hello.
He's a bit under the weather this week.
A bit.
Okay.
Just a touch.
Also at the table, Jenny Harrison Bunning.
Hello.
Now, as well as the Quarterly Magazine, you do publish, don't you, or republish a small number of books. Have you published any biography?
We've published a lot of memoirs, which are pretty close to biography.
I think I need a definition of the difference.
I would say a memoir is it's a selection from a life rather than cradle to grave, and it's a perfectly formed piece of writing in its own right, and a good memoir will encapsulate a particular period and a particular voice.
It doesn't pretend to be impartial either, does it?
No.
In the way that a biography
perhaps
tries to be.
Okay, so more on biography shortly. First though, what's going on at Hoxton Square this month?
I've just finished proofreading the book that we're going to be reissuing in the summer, which is Eric Newby's account of his time as an escaped prisoner of war in Italy, called Love and War in the Apennines. And we've got a wonderful introduction by Patrick French to it. And it is an incredibly moving story of a rather heroic period in his life.
Jenny, you've been busy, as always.
Yep, it's always lovely and busy in the spring, because after the issue comes out, then we have Mothering Sunday, and we always send lots of presents out for that. And then we have people who like to give subscriptions to the magazine as Easter presents. So the girls and I have been having a jolly time ribboning issues, writing gift messages. And we also were off in Bloomsbury last month to announce the winner of our Best First Biography Prize.
Oh, exciting.
And this year we had it at Mags Brothers, which was such a treat for us all, because they've never been anywhere with so many beautiful books on the shelves.
Tell people about Mags Brothers who don't know it.
Well, I don't know an enormous amount about the history of it. But it's now in Bedford Square in Bloomsbury, and they are dealers in kind of very rare manuscripts and books. And when you go in there, the shelves are just teeming with leather-bound
antiquarian books.
Mm. So that was great. So the winner of the prize was Bart Van Ayres, who won for The Cutout Girl, which also won the Costa Prize. But as Gail said, our prize is not from baristas, it's from the heart. So, it's only small. But
it's
from
people who love books.
Yes, exactly. Which is important.
And he was thrilled.
He's a lovely man. He's a professor of English literature at Oxford. He's Dutch. And The Cutaway Girl is about a Jewish girl whom his family took in during the war, and what happened to her subsequently. And he's now going to be writing for us on a couple of Dutch resistance novels, which I'm really excited about. And he's coming to our Reader's Day.
Excellent.
So the Reader's Day is in November.
When do you start offering tickets to that? Because it always sells out in a nanosecond, doesn't it?
Probably in early June, but they will be only for subscribers to begin with. And we only open it up to non-subscribers
To the Quarterly, I should point out, not
exactly,
the podcast.
Because we do feel that, you know, they're our greatest supporters and they keep us going, and that we like to give them first.
So if you subscribe to the Quarterly, you can put your hand up for tickets for this, because last year's was fantastic. Hazel, as I say, you're poorly. Have you been doing anything this month?
a certain amount. Of course, Gail and I are always busy reading proofs of the next issue, so we've been working on the summer issue, and I have to say there are some very treaty things in it, and I will just drop a hint to say that for Wodehouse fans, there's a lovely piece about Lord Emsworth and his pigs. And we've been reading the entries for the writers' competition, which we do every year. It's provided us with some very interesting pieces in the past, and we're gradually coming to a conclusion about this year's, and the results of that will be in the summer issue as well.
So lots going on. It's eerily quiet at the table. We have only the one dog with us this time. Yes. Regular listeners will know dogs often participate in the podcast. What about the neighbours' building work?
It seems to have ground to a halt. They're trying to install a new lift in the light well, and I think they've come a bit unstuck because the scaffolding has been up for months now and they haven't made much progress.
A silence reigns. Well, this is excellent.
But we're enjoying the piece while it lasts.
Yeah, fingers crossed for the next half an hour. Okay, so today, as we mentioned, we'll be looking at the fascinating and diverse field of biography, and we have the perfect guest with us, Adam Sisman, biographer of, among others, his fellow biographer, James Boswell, and more recently of the ultimate spy writer, John le Carré. Our recorded piece from the archive this time is on the biography theme. It's taken from William Palmer's essay about the biography of Edward Lear. Everyone at the table will have a recommended read for you later on, as they always do, none of which you will find on any bestseller list. And right at the very end, we have a new section, a new appendix, as it were. It's for all those listeners who've asked for a section with details on how and where to buy the books we discuss and any other bits and pieces that we think might be useful to you. So now you can either go to the show notes attached to the podcast if you're listening on an app, you can read them on the website, or you can listen out for the audio version right at the very end of every podcast. Never let it be said we don't listen to our listeners. So, Adam Sisman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be here.
You're known for your biographies of James Boswell, Hugh Trevor Roper, the historian, John le Carré. For anyone who doesn't know your work, do you want to give us a quick tour?
Well, it's an eccentric tour because I sort of stumbled into biography almost by accident. I always wanted to be a writer. I didn't know what to write. I always imagined I would write novels because I think that's what people who want to be a writer think about. But in fact, I became a publisher, and I was a sort of mediocre publisher for 15 years or so. And then by a series of accidents, I found myself writing a biography of my first book, which was a biography of A.J.P. Taylor. I'd never really thought about biography before. I mean, one of the things that startled me, really, was how quickly I got to know rather intimate things about my subject, things that, for example, his wife didn't know.
What sort of things?
Some of which I might not want to reveal. Personal matters.
Things.
Yes, yes. I mean, what really brought it home to me for the first time was sitting with the daughter of my subject, and she suddenly started crying. And I thought, good heavens, you know, I'm trampling on somebody's life.
Yes.
Up till that point, it had been all rather abstract. I'd never even met my subject. I suddenly realised how quickly you, as it were, barge into the private space of other people.
And did that change the way you went about it in future?
I think it made me more careful.
Yeah.
Do you ever decide consciously to omit details?
Oh, goodness, yes, definitely. Sometimes I'm asked to omit details.
I was wondering with you, in fact, sort of form a picture of the person before you start. And do you ever omit things that don't fit with
your thesis
about that person?
I think that's probably a bad idea, don't you?
I'm sure it's a very bad idea. I just wondered if you're ever tempted.
I think I have to have a lead-in in some way or other, some kind of idea. For example, my biography of Hugh Trevor Roper, another historian, I started with the idea that Hitler made him and Hitler unmade him. He became famous and successful because he wrote a best-selling book called The Last Days of Hitler, which, in fact, I've written about in the current number of Slightly Foxed. And then, of course, he was humiliated and disgraced to some extent by the disaster of the fake Hitler diaries. So there was a kind of arc of Hitler. But in fact, he was really a 17th century historian and found himself writing about Hitler by accident. To try and answer your question properly, yes, one starts with a thesis, but one needs to be flexible.
But you did say you do omit things. Obviously, you have to omit things. There's too much material, presumably, to put everything in. But on what basis do you omit?
If you're writing about a living person, or if you're writing about somebody who has close relatives living, you need to, I think, or at least if you're a decent human being, think about their feelings. So I've just written a biography of John le Carré, David Cornwall is his real name, who has a wife alive, he's alive, he has children, and one needs to, I think, be aware of all of this. There are sensitivities, and in that case, I had agreed with David that I would send him the typescript of my book when it was finished before it went to my publisher, and that I would take serious consideration any points representations he made to me, which I did, and I don't think I left out anything very important, but I left out one or two little things that he said might upset people or embarrass. And I think that's fair enough. I mean, you know, gosh, is there anyone alive who would want every single thing that they thought or said or done written about them? I mean, David said to me, I don't mind what happens after I'm dead.
But it's fascinating, isn't it, when you look back to biographies of people who are dead, which certainly before Michael Holroyd's groundbreaking book on Lytton Strachey were very often almost hagiography, great figures who were presented not warts and all at all, but and then of course Lytton Strachey himself in Eminent Victorians, you know, debunked, you know, four famous figures and reinterpreted them for a new generation. But I mean, Lytton Strachey's biography by Holroyd is full of revelations which one wonders whether, if he'd been alive, that would have been the case.
Talking of warts and all, I remember a comment made by David Cornwall to me when he'd read the first draft of my manuscript. He said, I know it's supposed to be warts and all, but it seems to be all warts and no all.
Was it a shock, in fact, when he came back with his own version?
Yes, because he published his own.
He published, that was a memoir, his own memoir. No, it wasn't a shock. He told me he wanted to do that. There wasn't anything in it.
Did you know that when you were actually writing?
Yes, I did. Yes. And anyway, it seems to me it's his life. He can do what he likes.
And of course, there's room for many interpretations, aren't there, when you think about big figures, just how many have been written about them, Churchill and the rest.
Yes, you were saying earlier that there are different kinds of biography. There are all sorts of different kinds of biography. And so my friend Alexander Masters, for example, has written a biography of someone, he doesn't know who she is. He just, he found some diaries in a skip.
That's so interesting. Who is she? When is she from?
Well, we don't know. That's the whole point.
What era is she? Yeah. Do we know that?
Yes. And I mean, I've just written a book which is coming out next month about a con man who, in a way, is unknowable. I use the analogy in my introduction of a particle in a cloud chamber. You can't actually see the particle. You can only see the path that it leaves behind. The devastation this man has left in his wake, including the abandoned wives, of which there were at least eight.
Right. It's extraordinary that Adam's doing this. It's called The Professor and the Parson. Right. And Adam wrote a biography, obviously, of Trevor Roper. Trevor Roper, in turn, also wrote a biography of a con man called Edmund Backhouse, who lived in Peking for years and sold, essentially forged, memoirs of the Chinese court back to publishing houses in Britain.
And of course was in the end, poor old Trevor Roper was humiliated by a con man in the disaster of the Hitler diaries.
Yeah, I mean, do we know how he came to make such a mistake?
Well, you need to read my biography of Hugh Trevor Roper.
Would you like to summarise it for us?
It really, and the mistake illustrates the sort of follies of journalism. He made his judgment really for journalistic reasons rather than for historical reasons, although he was fed a lot of false information that the paper had been authenticated, that the provenance of the diaries and so on had been authenticated.
And that wasn't true.
That turned out not to be true. But one of his reasons he thought they were authentic was simply that there was so much of them. He couldn't believe that a forger could have gone to so much labour.
They weren't terribly sort of likeable characters, were they, your two historians? Do you feel you have to sort of like your subject?
I personally think I wouldn't like to write a biography of someone who I thoroughly disliked, and I can't imagine that'd be much fun to read either. I want to spend my time in the company of people who may be flawed, but who I have some sympathy for.
And indeed respect for, I would imagine.
And respect for, definitely, yes.
Can I take us back to Boswell? Because it is supposed to be, I gather, the best biography in the English language. Why? I mean, I must admit, I've never opened it. What's so great about it?
A lot of people haven't opened it, and actually that's one good reason for reading my book. My book is really not a biography of Boswell. It's a book about a man writing a book and about how he put everything of himself into that book. And when he finally finished it, there was nothing left of him, and he promptly died.
We better explain who Boswell is for people.
Boswell was a young Scottish man from a good family who, but very eccentric. He had a very strict father who was a Lord of Session in the Scottish courts. That's a very distinguished legal position. and who much disapproved of his son and heir, James Boswell, who loved going to London. He loved women, and he loved the company of other writers and intellectuals, and he particularly worshipped Dr. Johnson, whose work he'd read, and then he achieved his ambition of being introduced to him, and he made a solemn pledge that he would write Johnson's biography, and he threw himself into this task. What I really try and do in my book is to sort of tease out how he wrote the book, what it meant to him, how he constructed the scenes, a series of vivid tableaus, like a play in a way, and they are extraordinarily vivid. And the result is that Dr. Johnson, even for people like yourself, many, many people haven't read the book, nevertheless is a living figure in our imagination, so much so that he can be portrayed by Robbie Coltrane in Blackadder, and we all know,
you know who he
that's
is.
Dr. Johnson, yeah. Yes. This is a very strange thing, that somebody from the past, as it were, becomes as vivid as a fictional character like Sherlock Holmes.
And the technique sounds like a very modern technique of writing biography.
It was, in a way, a modern technique, and there are all sorts of paradoxes about it, and not least that Boswell actually portrays events where, for example, when he managed to get Johnson together with John Wilkes, the notorious rake and radical, and he thought two more different men could not be imagined. But in fact, they got on rather well. What they started doing was teasing Boswell and mocking him. And so Boswell portrays himself being teased and mocked by these two men that he's brought together.
How long did it take Boswell to research and write this?
7 years. Johnson was a kind of celebrity in his lifetime. And when he died, I think 7 biographies were announced within 2 weeks of his death. And all the others were published long before Boswell's. And everyone said, oh, you've missed the boat. But in fact, he wrote what still remains the greatest biography in the English language.
But it's interesting, isn't it, with some biographies that come out these days, which are absolutely enormous. I'm just thinking of Margaret Thatcher's biography, which is 3 volumes, I think. And, you know, is anybody really going to sit down and read 3 volumes of a life?
Well, yes and no. I mean, look at Robert Carrier's biography of Lyndon Johnson. A good writer can sustain the reader's interest over an extended period. Mm. But I'm all in favour of short biographies too. Mm. Some while ago, Sebastian Foakes wrote a book about 3 people and short vignettes.
It's Fatal Englishman.
The Fatal Englishman. Yeah.
Exactly. In fact, one of them was Richard Hillary.
Whose memoir
we've done, which is The Last Enemy.
Yes.
So it's incredibly moving.
But it is sort of the detail, isn't it, that makes a life.
Yes, Boswell compared it to portraiture. He said that there's a speck of paint that gives life to the eye.
Do you read biography, Jenny?
I do, and partly, or mainly, because I'm at Slightly Fox, and, you know, our own list of memoirs has kind of got me in, definitely more into reading non-fiction. I think when I started here, I would have predominantly read fiction.
Yeah.
But certainly, and I don't know if it's as I'm getting older, but certainly I'm really enjoying reading non-fiction and biographies and about real people.
I think it is definitely true that readers of biography tend to be older readers. Mm. But a good biography should be as entertaining as a good novel, in my opinion.
Such an interesting subject, but I think we better move on, sadly.
Just before we do, I just wanted to say that we're going to be featuring Adam's book in our summer readers' catalogue, so anyone who wants to know more about that will get a copy of the catalogue with their summer issue of Slightly Fox.
And the name of the book is, remind me?
The Professor and the Parson.
And tell me about the reader's catalogue, because not everyone will know about that.
Yeah, well, this is just one of the sort of little extras that we give subscribers. It goes out with each issue of the magazine, and it lists not only all the books that we ourselves produce at Slightly Fox, so the Cubs, the editions, the plain editions and the paperbacks and all of our sort of extra things that we do, like the slipcases and book bags and book plates. But Anna also puts together a selection of kind of recommended reading from other publishers, just things that have caught our eye and that we just think Slightly Fox readers will like. So it's a sort of hand-picked selection of the best of the rest.
Okay, yeah. And that comes out when?
So that'll be coming out with the summer issue. So Smith Settle put it in the envelope with the issue and it goes out around the world.
And that's in June?
Yeah, that's in June.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that. Let's move on to our reading from the Slightly Foxed archive. It's an appreciation this time by William Palmer of a biography of Edward Lear.
One day there appeared at luncheon, sitting opposite to us, a rosy, grey-bearded, bald-headed, gold-spectacled old gentleman who captivated my attention. Something seemed to bubble and sparkle in his talk, and his eyes twinkled benignly. This was one small American girl's first meeting with Edward Lear in 1870. At about the same time, he was writing of himself in his diary, broken down with a hideous load of sorrow. When Vivian Noakes's biography of Lear was first published in 1968, the cartoonist Ronald Searle hailed it as magnificent. This was deserved praise for the woman who devoted herself to revealing the talents of the man too often seen simply as runner-up to Lewis Carroll as the great Victorian children's writer. I had no idea of the mixture of warmth and terrible darkness in Lear's life until I read Noakes's book. Edward Lear was born in 1812 in Holloway, London, the penultimate of 21 children. His father was a stockbroker, but even for a wealthy man, such a huge family was a considerable burden. Edward, aged 4, was left in the charge of his 25-year-old sister, Anne. These difficulties were horribly exacerbated 2 years later, when he suffered the first attack of what he called the demon, epileptic fits that occurred almost every day for the rest of his life. He quickly learned to recognise an oncoming attack, to hide himself away and to suffer each in isolation. He did not go to school until he was 11, and the experience was painful. What saved him from despair was being taught by his sisters to paint and draw. His natural talent was such that he was able to support himself as a freelance artist from the age of 15. His work was his salvation. Many years later he wrote, "I hate life unless I always work." He started off, ignominiously, selling sketches to coach passengers in the yards of inns, but he rapidly became a sought-after illustrator of natural history books. A folio of drawings of parrots, published before he was 20, was judged to equal, if not excel, the great American wildlife painter Audubon, and led to an invitation to the Earl of Derby's estate to draw the animals in a private menagerie. Lear was found so entertaining that he was soon invited to dine with the family. In the next few years he was passed from one aristocratic family to another, each charmed by the large, ungainly young man, able to draw, sing, play the piano and flute, and above all amuse their children with his verses and stories. When Lord Derby and others clubbed together to provide him with enough money to go to Rome for 2 years, in return for drawings he would make, Lear found liberation in simply being away from England. Breezily accepting the most difficult of living conditions, and often travelling through virtually unexplored country, the works he produced on his travels are a triumph of spirit over depression and suffering. But it is for his nonsense that most of us remember Lear. His first work for children, A Book of Nonsense, containing his limericks and extraordinary drawings, appeared in 1846, and was followed by a book of verses, stories, and comic alphabets. But the nonsense was not something concocted to charm children. It spilled out from his personality in the almost surreal verbal contortions and drawings that fill the letters he wrote to friends. He always maintained he was weak at drawing the human figure, but the cartoons of himself as a tall, heavy figure, dancing, painting, or walking in great strides on legs as long as stilts, are a delight. Despite a lively appreciation of women, Lear never married. Vivian Noakes believed he was a suppressed homosexual, and he did indeed become very attached to the younger men who sometimes accompanied him on his travels. He invested deep trust and feelings in these relationships, and was devastated when they ended. But Lear left plenty of evidence in his diaries and letters that he pined after marriage, and he came close on more than one occasion. In his final book of verses, he wrote with affecting sadness of his position. "Lady Jingly, Lady Jingly, sitting where the pumpkins blow, will you come and be my wife?" said the Yongy Bongy Bo. "I'm tired of living singly on this coast so wild and shingly. I'm a-weary of my life. If you'll come and be my wife, quite serene would be my life," said the Yongy Bongy Bo, said the Yongy Bongy Bo. In later life, Lear settled in the Italian coastal city of San Remo with Giorgio, his Greek servant of many years. He had taken to drinking large quantities of Marsala, and the odd couple often fell to arguing. Lear also began to have trouble with his sight, and attacks of dizziness. It was at this low point that he drew together his last and greatest verses in laughable lyrics, including the wonderful Dong with a luminous nose, the Quangle Wangle's hat, and other poems whose combination of sadness and humour sum up his own life, and which have provided pleasure and enchantment to others ever since.
And that was Nigel Anthony reading an extract from William Palmer's essay on the biography of Edward Lear, which was published, I think, in Slightly Foxed issue number 56, have I got that right? Such a sad life, so unexpected, I had no idea.
It makes me want to read the biography.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
But also to look at the art. He travelled to places like Albania where, I mean, conditions were simply frightful and he endured terrible privations and dangers.
He does sound very much like a character after Dickens, doesn't he? I mean, I was thinking about David Copperfield during the recording.
Yeah. It's a remarkable life. Fascinating piece, then. If you enjoyed Nigel's reading, you can hear more from him because right now he's appearing in an all-star cast in Jarvis and Eyre's production of Sheridan's A School for Scandal. That's BBC Radio 3.
Yes, and Anna and I actually last month we were back in Soho at the recording studio because Nigel's been recording more readings for us. And then we've also got other actors reading pieces on Finnegan's Wake, Speed Dating with Iris Murdoch.
Those essay recording days are always great fun. We do them every 6 months and we batch record essays for future podcasts. And it is a festival of voice artists and actors showing up and reading for us. We always thoroughly enjoy them. Elegant and entertaining, Slightly Foxed is the literary quarterly for nonconformists. It introduces readers to all those wonderful books that languish on publishers' backlists but disappear from bookshops. Its contributors are established writers, journalists, and people from many fields. They all share their passion for particular books and authors, and since it's entirely independent, Slightly Foxed is free to follow its own nose and celebrate the offbeat. So why not take out a subscription? Happily, it's a bargain. £48 for a year's print subscription and free access to all the back issues in the digital archive. Here's the web address, foxedquarterly.com. Or if you'd rather talk to a human, give Hattie a call. She's on 020 7033 0258. Thank you. And talking of subscriptions, I think I'm right in saying that every issue of the Quarterly goes off to subscribers in, is it 60 countries? Is that right?
Yes, about 60.
It's amazing. But I do happen to know the Foxes are rather keen to grow that number. So if you live somewhere off the beaten track, like, I don't know, Cape Verde or St. Kitts or somewhere like that, please do subscribe because it'll make their day. Right, book recommendations time. We've reached that time. Adam, why don't you start us off?
Well, I've just reread a book I read a long time ago, Kingsley Amis's The Green Man, which I must say I much enjoyed on the second reading. I mean, he's the narrator, in a way, is an appalling person and a drunk, but it's a scintillating read, and it's possibly unique in having a scene in which our hero has a conversation with God. God appears in his dining room.
That sounds like an excellent read. Hazel.
Well, I'd like to recommend, it's a book in two parts, really. It's by someone called Dennis Constanduris, who was an artist. This is a picture of the author's grandfather, who was, in a way, the spirit of all that was solid, reliable, convivial, and also slightly dishonest about the Victorian age, and the author's own father, who was completely the reverse and who was sort of raffish, unreliable. And these two men, in their contrasting ways, somehow sum up both the good side and the bad side of the Victorian age. And it's very, very funny. But it also captures absolutely beautifully these two characters.
It has lovely illustrations.
It has
Hazel,
lovely
as well,
illustrations,
doesn't it?
Yes, by the author. The first part was read on radio and when it was first published in 1948, and it was tremendously popular, and then it kind of disappeared from view, and now it's been reissued. It's in two parts. The first part is called My Grandfather, and the second part is called Father, Dear Father by Dennis Constanduris.
Thank you. Jenny?
Yeah. I've just started, I'm into the first few chapters of The Cutout Girl, and I just thought, well, you know, it won our prize and it's had such fantastic reviews, so I've just started that, and it essentially, it's the story of this little girl who is given away by her parents before the war in the hope that she will survive the war. And she does. She's fostered by a family. And then after the war, she discovers that her parents, you know, didn't make it. And then later on, she has a falling out with the family. I mean, I haven't got to this point yet. And it becomes this sort of great family secret. And then Bart, who is the grandson of the foster family, he just decided that he really had to get to the bottom of it. So he goes off sleuthing and discovers that this woman is still alive and she's in her 80s and living in Amsterdam. And he goes off there, and at first she's incredibly reluctant. You know, she doesn't want to talk to him. She doesn't want to have her story told. But slowly they strike up this friendship, and then they actually sort of become partners in a way, and they work together to untangle the story of what really happened with this family.
It sounds great.
At the launch party, Bart actually got Lien on Skype, and he had her up on his screen, and he was showing her the room at Mag's and showing us all
Toast.
And it was incredibly moving, and his family obviously care very deeply about her. And I'm looking forward to finding out what happens.
Gail?
I've just finished a trilogy by Tim Pears, which is essentially a love story. And the first volume starts in 1911 on the borders of Devon and Somerset on an estate. And it follows the fortunes of a young boy called Leo, whose father is a carter. And Leo develops a great love for horses. And he develops a friendship with the daughter of the man who owns the estate. And of course, they come from completely different backgrounds. And at the end of the first book, something terrible happens, which I won't reveal. And his family lose their cottage and lose their livelihood. Mm. And Leo, in the second volume, sets out on the road through Devon and has all sorts of adventures. But as he passes through Devon, you're given this wonderful evocation of rural life at the time. He crosses Dartmoor, which is pretty bleak. And he then joins the Navy, and the final volume starts with the Battle of Jutland, and he's hauling coal on one of the warships. Various twists and turns in the story. He eventually goes back to Devon, where the young girl has become, very unusually for the time, a vet. And basically they end up marrying.
Well, you've told us now.
Sorry, yes, I have. Oh, dear. It's a wonderfully lyrical description and an evocation of a period. It's absolutely pitch perfect. Can't recommend it highly enough.
I think we might have guessed they ended up marrying.
Yes, I'm sorry. So the first volume is called The Horseman, the second one is The Wanderers, and the third is The Redeemed.
Well, congratulations. Varied, I think, would be the word I'd use for those recommendations. They're great. Thank you. I am looking at the clock. We've eaten up our time for this month, so I'm going to call a halt now and say thank you very much to Adam Sisman for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back on May 15th with an episode all about bookshops and booksellers with two guests, Brett Wollstonecroft of Daunt Books in Marylebone, lovely bookshop, and Kathleen Smith of Toppings, another lovely bookshop in Bath. If you have enjoyed what you've heard, please do tell your friends, write us a review, you can rate us on your podcast app, and most fun of all, subscribe to the Quarterly Magazine. If you'd like to know how to get hold of the books we've talked about, as I said, you can find all that information and more in the show notes on your podcast app or on the website, that's foxedquarterly.com. Or if you would rather hear me reel them all off, keep listening at the end of the podcast and I will do just that in our new appendix section. So remember, next month's bookshops, booksellers, thank you for listening and for joining us off the beaten track. Here's the appendix for episode 6. If you'd like to get in touch, visit the website www.foxedquarterly.com. The email address is office@foxedquarterly.com. You can phone on 020 7033 0258, or if you'd rather write, the address is 53 Hoxton Square, London N1 6PB. If you'd like to make a purchase, copies of the current issue, all the back issues and in-print books are all available in the Slightly Foxed online shop, and good bookshops all around the UK and overseas. You can find a full list on the website, foxedquarterly.com/stockists.
If your local bookshop doesn't yet stock the magazine or the books, they can order them in for you. Just ask them to contact Anna in the Slightly Foxed office. Single issues of the magazine, as well as books, goods and subscriptions, can be shipped worldwide. If you subscribe to the Quarterly, you'll receive more than four beautifully produced printed issues of the magazine every year. Subscribers also receive a host of other benefits, such as early booking for events, preferential prices for books and goods, access to the full digital archive of all the back issues, the annual Reader's Catalogue, offers from Slightly Foxed partner organisations, that's bookshops and festivals such as the Royal Society of Literature, Gladstone's Library, various independent bookshops and reading retreats, and much more besides. A subscription makes a great gift. The first issue can be wrapped in the signature Slightly Foxed brown paper and cream ribbon and sent out with a handwritten gift card in time for a date of your choosing. Subscriptions start at £48, including UK postage for the year, with a special 10% discount for readers aged under 30. For the full range of subscriptions, go to foxedquarterly.com/subscribe. And here are details of all the Slightly Foxed books, goods and events that we mentioned in this episode. Love and War in the Apennines by Eric Newby will be published as a Slightly Foxed edition in cloth-bound hardback on the 1st of June. It's now available to pre-order on the website at £17 for subscribers and £18.50 for non-subscribers, including UK postage. The Slightly Foxed 2019 Reader's Day will be held on Saturday, 2nd of November, at the Art Workers Guild in Bloomsbury in central London. Tickets go on sale late May to Slightly Foxed magazine subscribers only, from £60. Adam Sisman's article on Hugh Trevor Roper's The Last Days of Hitler is published in the current spring issue of Slightly Foxed. You can buy the issue for £12 if you're a subscriber and £12.50 if you're not. The Last Enemy by Richard Hillary is available as a Slightly Foxed edition in cloth-bound hardback, £17 for subscribers and £18.50 for non-subscribers. William Palmer's article on Vivian Noakes's Edward Lear, The Life of a Wanderer, was published in Slightly Foxed issue 56. That's available to buy as a single issue, £13 for subscribers and £14 for non-subscribers. Buy a set of any four single issues and you save £1 per issue. My Grandfather and Father Dear Father by Dennis Constanduros are available in a single edition or in a special Last Call bundle, together with the last copies of the earliest available limited edition. That's The Flame Trees of Theca by Elspeth Huxley. The show notes list all the other issues, books, goods and events mentioned in this episode, along with other useful information. You can find them on the Slightly Foxed website, foxedquarterly.com/well-written-life. The full essay reading from this episode is available to Slightly Foxed magazine subscribers only on the website, foxedquarterly.com/well-written-life. Please note you will need to log in to view this content. For anything else, please visit www.foxquarterly.com/pod. Thank you.